we begin our third case of the day, we have some students with us today from Lake Mills High School. And I did chat with them a little bit over the, well, it wasn't really a noon hour, it was like about a noon half hour. But in any case, would they please stand so the court can see them all? It's a fine group, good questions too. Thank you, please be seated. Now I'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him is Justice David Prosser. Next to Justice Prosser is Justice Abrahamson. I'm Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
If I may, I'd like to give a shout out to my cousin Natalie, who's a student in Lake Mills.
Next to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is Justice Ziegler, and next to Justice Ziegler is Justice Rebecca Bradley. All right. With those introductions, I think we're set to go. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Better?
Yep, much better. Thank you.
My name is John Cray. I represent the defendant, appellant, and petitioner in this case, Patrick Tourville. This case has two really separate issues that I think are both very interesting. One is whether the state, the prosecutor, breached the plea agreement when he asked the judge to order consecutive sentences. And the second issue is whether there's a factual basis on one of the charges that he took and carried away property of another. I think they're both interesting issues. I'm not positive which one, if the court is more interested in one than the other. I thought I would start with the plea breach issue, but I'm happy to go to the other issue at any point that I'm directed.
When I was preparing for this case, I went through some questions, and one of my questions was going to be just exactly as you're suggesting, and I was going to say, which one is your better argument? And your response, by the way, is they're both good.
They're both excellent arguments.
So I won't ask the question because I know the answer.
In some ways, I'm more interested in the first one because I think that would do my client more good. That's not necessarily a comment on the legalities of
What's
it.
What's your client asking for? Resentencing,
repleading before a different judge. That's the common remedy for a breach of a plea agreement. It's also possible in some circumstances to withdraw the plea. I think we would be asking for, in the post-conviction motion, we asked for resentencing before a different judge. And it has to be a different judge who hasn't heard the what I would call a contaminated recommendation.
And the contamination is?
The contamination is that the judge now knows that the prosecutor wanted and asked for consecutive sentences. Now, if that's a breach of the plea agreement, which is what we contend it is, then the prosecutor knows something. I'm sorry, the judge knows something that the judge shouldn't know, which is the state, even though they're not recommending consecutive sentences, really wants that. And so that's why in all these cases you have to have a different judge who hasn't heard about what the recommendation is.
Yeah, as I looked at the question of whether the plea agreement was breached, the issue kept coming up to me as it didn't appear that they talked about whether the sentences would be consecutive or concurrent during the time they were negotiating the plea agreement. Do you want to address why I shouldn't be concerned about that lack of discussion on that issue?
Sure. I think that's somewhat unusual. It wasn't talked about at the time of the plea. Generally, at the time of a plea, you get on the record, here's the terms of the plea agreement. And then often you do that at the sentencing as well, saying here's what we promised to do, here's what we're doing. That was not on the record. And I think one of the state's arguments is that calls into question what is the actual plea agreement. from my standpoint, the plea agreement was adequately documented. It was written on the plea questionnaires to three of the four cases. There's four counts of various crimes here. On three of them, and he pled guilty on all four, guilty or no contest, all four of them at the same hearing, same time. And the plea questionnaire set forth exactly what the plea agreement was, and that was the state will cap its recommendation at the high end of what the PSI orders. Now, the PSI never orders anything, so I think we have to read that as what the PSI recommends. That's the state's cap. It will cap its recommendation at the high end of what the PSI recommends. Okay? I think, so that was, to get back to your question, I think that was on the record. It was admitted at the time of the plea. It was accepted by the court and put into the record. And that's where all the evidence comes as to what was the actual plea. There, at the post-conviction hearing, where we alleged a breach of the plea agreement, we also added two letters that had come from the prosecutor to the defense attorney, Attorney Miller, which also laid that out, which is the plea agreement is the state will cap its recommendation at the high end of what the PSI orders. That's where that language came from. It was in the letter. It made its way then to the plea questionnaire. It was entered in. And in addition to that, at the time of the post-conviction hearing, Attorney Miller testified that was his understanding of the plea agreement. It wasn't altered or changed in any way. And so I think that is adequate, definitive, undisputed, it's evidence as to here's what the plea agreement was. Even though it wasn't brought up at the time of the hearing, it was in black and white. Now, the prosecutor at the post-conviction hearing said, well, I never saw that. And my response is, that's not my fault. It's not Mr. Turville's fault. It was put on the plea questionnaire forms, accepted by the judge, and put into the record.
Okay, but when you say capping it at the high end of the PSI recommendation, the recommendation was silent on consecutive or concurrent. And my concern was, if we're talking about a plea, quote, agreement, you have to discuss something before you can have an agreement. I didn't see anything in what I read that this item, concurrent or consecutive, was discussed. And what I hear you saying is, well, it had to be concurrent, because if it was consecutive, that would have been higher than any individual recommendation in the PSI. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think it's accurate to say that the recommendation called for concurrent.
I don't think it called for anything. That's my understanding.
It didn't call for concurrent or consecutive.
Right.
So
right.
The question is, when the prosecutor then recommended, I want consecutive sentences, does that go beyond basically a non-recommendation? To follow the plea agreement, I think the prosecutor would have had to have said, Judge, the PSI recommends four sentences with time on each of those. I ask you to follow that recommendation, sentence him to the high end of those ranges, and I have no recommendation as to whether the sentences should be concurrent or consecutive.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So he should have just been quiet about that.
Quiet or explicitly say, I have no recommendation.
Okay.
That would have been in accordance with the plea agreement. And, okay, Justice Breyer.
According to my very simple calculations, looking at the interesting chart, we got 18 months on one, that's maximum, page 5 of your brief. 18 months would be the maximum on one. 6 years would be another. 18 months on a third. And 2 years on a fourth. According to my math, that adds up just on recommended here to 11 years.
As to what was actually...
Of PSI recommendation, and the high end of all those things is 11 years.
Or maybe six.
Well, the high end is 11 years.
I think the high end is six, but take
Isn't
a look.
Isn't that 9.5? Yep, six plus two plus two 18 months. That's
right.
Six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11.5, I think.
Well, okay. What is your idea of the high end of that?
The high end of that, that is the high end of that. All these were expressed in ranges, 16 to 18 months, 4 to 6 years. The high end means 6 years. If the recommendation is 4 to 6 years on one of the counts, the high end of that is 6 years.
Well, let's see, if you take the, of all the things that are recommended, if you take the low end and add them up, I suppose your idea is that the low end of the highest sentence would be 4 years, and that everything else is concurrent with that. But how could you possibly argue that that's at the high end of everything that's being recommended here?
I'm not positive. I'm getting on that, Justice. The four, I think you're right about the low end, which I don't think there's much relevance to the low end, but the low end would be 4 years and everything else is concurrent. But I'm not saying that the prosecutor needed to say, I want these concurrent. All he had to say is, I want the low end of those ranges, and I have no opinion. I leave it to the sound discretion of the court whether those should be consecutive or concurrent.
And you meant to say high end. The prosecutor wanted the high end of those ranges. That's what he should have said.
The prosecutor wanted the high end of those ranges, and then he added something that was absolutely not in the plea agreement, which is, I also want those sentences consecutive to each other. That is nowhere in the PSI. And that's what I'm saying. That's the essential breach. It goes beyond.
Did he give a number of years specifically? Did he recommend 11 years?
No, he did not.
I think he did.
I think maybe he recommended each one individually, the initial confinement and the extended supervision, and then the total 11
years. He couldn't recommend 11 years without having consecutive sentences.
But he didn't recommend 11 years. I think he did them individually. He said, I'm reading on page 37 of the sentencing transcript, I think I got this right, that he says, on 13 CF 107, I'd request a 4-year sentence, 2 years initial confinement, 2 years extended supervision. So at least on that one, I think he's going through each one and giving the high end of each one. But then after that, he says something that was not in the PSI. I also want these consecutive.
Who's he?
District Attorney Daniel Stephan.
The judge is a she.
The judge is a she. And as you...
It just seems to me, Mr. Frey, that the high end of all these recommendations is 11 years. And, by saying consecutive sentences, it could have been simply the low end of all those things, or the middle of all those things.
Well, I think that's the state's argument, that the high end includes that term consecutive. I think that's the state's argument, and I hope to dissuade you from that, or else I lose. But I think the high end is the high end of the range that was recommended, 16 to 18 months. The high end of that is 18 months. But to add a whole new element into it, which regards to how should these sentences be arranged in relation to each other, I think that has to be, that's not spoken of in the PSI. And if it's not spoken of in the PSI, I don't see how it can fairly be spoken of at sentencing. It's a
How do you I'm sorry, you're done. Go ahead.
Well, it just seems to me, if I were sitting as the trial judge here, the sentencing judge, and I look at all these recommendations, and counsel said to me, Your Honor, I'm looking for the high end of all these recommendations. It would seem to me you would have to have some consecutive sentences there.
I don't agree with that. I don't think you have to put consecutive on that at all. I think the high end, to me, means the high end of the range. That does not speak to whether they should be consecutive or not. To honor the agreement, you would have to say, I don't make a recommendation as to whether they should be concurrent or consecutive. That's the agreement, as I see it.
Now, the consecutive, is that, are we talking about these four sentences? Wasn't he also serving a prior sentence?
I don't think that would change the analysis. I honestly can't remember if he was. I don't think he was. Could be wrong on that. But I don't think that would change the analysis.
You're talking about the four sentences, and you think they should be concurrent with each other.
Oh, I don't. Well, I think that would be nice for my client. But I think all I'm asking for is that the state honor its recommendation to not go beyond what is in the PSI.
If the state honors what you think is the plea agreement, goes back for a new sentencing, then you'd argue this is what the plea agreement is, and the trial judge doesn't have to accept it, right?
Of course, right.
And then can decide how much to give.
That's right.
Consecutive, concurrent, maximum, less than maximum.
That's right. And of course, what this judge did is irrelevant to that. This judge did give consecutive sentences. That might be because this judge thought those were warranted. It might be because the sentencing recommendation played a role in that. And generally, sentence recommendations of prosecutors are very instrumental. But we can't know that. And I would have no complaint if the judge, on this issue anyway, if the judge gave consecutive sentences. I would have had no complaint if the PSI had come in and asked for consecutive sentences. They were kind of gambling. Both sides were gambling a little bit here, saying whatever the PSI says, that will cap the recommendation. If the recommendation of the PSI had come in and said, I want max on everything consecutive, I have no argument. Because whatever the PSI said, that's what governs what the prosecutor can say. Since the PSI didn't say consecutive, then I don't think he can say it at sentencing.
Yeah, let me ask this. Could the prosecutor have said, Your Honor, I would like 9.5 years?
I think he could say that. It would be at some risk because I can imagine an appellate lawyer like myself might come in saying that sort of end running it, and that you only get to 9.5 by making them consecutive, and you're not supposed to say it's consecutive. So I think you could say, I'm getting that 9.5 just by adding them up. That's what they come to. But I'm not making a recommendation as to whether they should be consecutive or concurrent. So I don't know why you would really add them up to the 9.5 to begin with. But so I think that would be dicey.
Well, high end of what?
I think the high end of the range. The range came in. There's ranges on each of these, 4 to 6 years, 1 to 2 years. He wants to go to the high end of that range. But why would that include the ability to go consecutive? I mean, the PSI author could have put in there, I want them consecutive. Did not do that. And since that didn't have it, I don't see how you can now add that new element. That's the crux of the argument.
If the court didn't make them consecutive, then they would be concurrent, right?
That's right.
And is there any support in a statute, a
case or the law that the PSI writer has a, that there's a similar outcome when it comes to a PSI writer's recommendations?
You know, I think both the state and I looked for cases that had similar language to this, and there isn't that. What I did put in my brief is a number of cases, and it's very clear that when a judge in pronouncing sentences doesn't say consecutive, that means concurrent. And that goes back to 1922 or something in re application of McDonald. It's a very old case. And that's very clear. And I think that at least informs what this should mean. I understand it's not a perfect analogy, but I think it informs it. When a judge doesn't say consecutive, it means concurrent. You have to apply it that way. When a PSI doesn't say it, again, my argument is you can't go beyond whatever was in that agreement. It goes beyond it. And to me, it kind of shows the intent of the PSI author was not to be consecutive. I can't say concurrent, but if the PSI author had wanted to say consecutive, could have said consecutive, didn't. So I think it's like a judge at sentencing. Does that evince an intent to ask for concurrent? I think that's the better conclusion than if you asked for than to assume like, well, that includes consecutive.
Counsel, the issue you're focusing on is was there a breach of a plea agreement?
That's right.
And as is often the case, the way you shape the beginning of the analysis is outcome determinative. And here, I can shape it in two ways. Like the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court, I can say there was no breach of an agreement because there was no agreement. They didn't talk about it. And so there is no breach of an agreement. If I shape it the way you are advancing it, and that is essentially you focus on the high end of the PSI recommendation. Well, we have the table in front of us. You see the numbers. Indeed, the PSI did not make reference at all to consecutive or concurrent.
Right.
So there was no, I think you can argue, there was no recommendation. That's what you argue. There is no recommendation by consecutive or concurrent. It's silent. There's nothing there. So for the prosecutor to go beyond what is in the PSI recommendation is a breach.
That's
so,
right.
So you've got, you know, the same issue, was there a breach? And if you scope the analysis on one path, well, there's no breach. There was no agreement. They didn't talk about it. Or you scope it on the way you're doing it, and that is the other path of there was nothing in the recommendation of the PSI that it was concurrent or consecutive. It was silent. And to argue something that went beyond the recommendation is a breach. So why should I take your way rather than the other
way?
Well,
if I'm getting you right, Justice Bradley, if there was no plea agreement, then I don't have anything. I'll just go home.
But you have your other
I think there was a plea agreement, and I think that's evidenced by what was in the plea questionnaire and what was testified to by the prosecutor and the letters from the district attorney. I think that's adequate proof that there was a plea agreement. Now,
that's why I say the focus. One focuses on whether or not they discussed consecutive and concurrent. Was that their agreement? Another focuses on the language of the letters and the plea advisement and waiver of rights form, and the question is whether or not it went beyond the recommendation set forth in the PSI. I mean, it's just a matter of focus. Maybe I'm not being clear enough.
Well,
I've repeated it three times,
clear.
And so further the affiant saith not. That's fine.
Well, are you questioning?
I'm questioning why should I go your route rather than the other route. I could write it both ways, and hopefully,
and hopefully it would analytically flow.
Do you mean as to whether there's a plea agreement or as to what
whether
the
there
terms
was a breach of a, whether there was a breach of a plea agreement is the issue that I would address. But I think we're not tracking, so I don't want to take any more of your time.
I want to move you into your other issue of the factual basis.
Sure.
And my question to you is, did the state have charged receiving stolen property?
Well, they could have. Sure.
And you charged both receiving stolen property and stealing the same property?
I didn't study that issue, but I think under a case called TAPA, I think you could charge in one theft various things. You could say you took and carried it away. You could also have concealed it. You could also have retained it.
It's
so
all theft.
They all could have been charged. In this case, they only charged one thing. He took and carried away.
Right. Receiving and stolen property is knowingly or intentionally receiving or concealing stolen property.
Sure. And under the facts of the complaint, you know, if those are true, he did some of those things. What he didn't do is what he pled to, which is took and carried away. He didn't even know about it.
Well, I gather from your brief that the taking and carrying away was a completed crime by the time they got the safe to his house or to his property. Is that right?
It was a completed crime. That's right.
And therefore, he couldn't be part of that as a completed crime.
Couldn't be part of it. Didn't help it. Didn't know about it.
And the cases that are cited by the state are aiding and abetting either before the crime was committed or during the commitment of
That's right.
the crime.
Exactly right.
Or while the crime is ongoing, which may be the same as during. But in here,
all of them.
They removed that safe. They took the safe. They carried it away. And at that time, they intentionally deprived the owner of the property.
That's right.
I mean, that's your, as I read it, that's your case.
That's right.
And that he didn't participate in any of that.
He moved it from point B to point C. And you have to, under the statute and under other case law that I've cited in the brief, you have to move it from point A to B.
And he was
he moved it from B to C.
Okay.
And that's maybe a crime, it may be theft, but it isn't taking and carrying away movable
property.
But,
you know, you ask for a resentencing, but the receiving stolen property, if the property here is a firearm, is that the property or is it the safe or is it both?
I think it's both. It became a felony because there were weapons in the safe.
Right. And that's a Class H felony to receive stolen property, right? And then it's a Class H felony if you steal, theft, the guns. So the sentence is the same. I mean, the range of the sentence is the same.
Right, that's right.
So why would you get a resentence on that issue?
What would we get out of this?
No, what do you get out of it, yes. And
well,
I can see you saying because it's not a theft that you have to replead.
No, I understand.
I don't see how you get a new sentence.
I think if there's not a factual basis, you have that conviction shouldn't be there.
Withdrawing the plea.
It's a requirement that you have a factual basis.
Right.
If there isn't one, it's no good. If we go back, you know, maybe they'll recharge it under the proper statute. I don't know what will happen with that.
But if you ask for resentencing, why will they recharge it? That's my problem.
If we ask for resentencing under the first issue?
Well, did you ask for resentencing under the second issue?
No, under the second issue, it's asking for plea withdrawal on that crime. If there's not
issue.
A factual basis,
right.
That can't stand.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Prey began his argument by saying that this case raises two separate issues. And as the parties briefed this case, both in the Court of Appeals and in this court, we treated them as two separate issues. But as I was preparing for the argument, it occurs to me that they are not necessarily unrelated. And I'm not springing this on Mr. Prey as a surprise. I shared my thought, the point I'm about to make with you, with him last week. Tourville was charged with a total of 14 counts. I said in my brief 13, I miscounted. It's a total of 14 counts in four cases. The parties reached a package plea agreement under which he pled guilty or no contest to one count and the other in each of the four cases, and the other 13 charges were dismissed. Now, on the theft case that we were just talking about, he's asking to withdraw his plea on that. He's also asking to be resentenced on the other three counts. But there are numerous cases that hold that when a defendant challenges a plea to one count in a package plea agreement, that constitutes a repudiation of the plea agreement. And the usual remedy for that is a reinstatement of the original charges. So if this court were to agree with Mr. Tourville's claim that he should be allowed to withdraw the plea on the theft count, it should conclude that he has repudiated the plea agreement. Now, I am not asking this court to decide the remedy. I think that's something that is best addressed in the circuit court by the prosecutor and defense counsel. But I think there is an inconsistency between his saying, on counts 1 through 3, I want a new sentencing hearing under the plea agreement, and trying to withdraw his plea to one of those charges under his second argument. So I think.
And what's your authority for that, counsel?
Most recently, this court's decision in Robinson, 2002, Wisconsin 9, paragraph 47. The principle goes back at least as far as Polhammer, 78 with second, 516. So it is possible that if Mr. Tourville then is allowed to withdraw his plea on one of the four counts to which he has pled guilty, the state and he start over again, and the sentencing argument, the breach of plea at sentencing, becomes moot. As I said, I am not asking this court to determine the remedy, but I am pointing out that there is an interrelationship here. And if the court were to agree with him on the lack of factual basis and that he should be allowed to withdraw the plea, that will affect the sentencing remedy.
According to your brief, you say the court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, affirming the judgments of conviction and deny post-conviction relief. So it's your theory that, one, the theft charge is good under aiding and abetting?
Correct.
And your theory is that the plea agreement, if there was one, hasn't been breached?
Correct.
And you're not sure there was one?
Well,
or are you sure now that there was one?
I am not sure now. I will proceed in my argument as on the assumption that the plea agreement required the state to limit its recommendation to the high end. This circuit court did not make a factual finding on that point. It said, presuming that that was the plea agreement, the state did not breach it. The Court of Appeals, in its discussion of the factual background, simply said with no explanation that that was the agreement. So I'll argue on the assumption that that was the agreement, but I think certainly the fact that this was never discussed at the plea hearing or the sentencing hearing, at the post-conviction hearing, defense counsel acknowledged that this addendum to the plea questionnaire was given directly to the court, was never shown to the prosecutor. I think if the court disagrees with my analysis under the assumption that this was the plea agreement, there needs to be a fact finding.
And it should be remanded for that.
And it should be remanded.
And your position, if I understand it, is that there was never an agreement about consecutive or concurrent.
There certainly was no agreement on, assuming the agreement was to cap at the high end, there was no agreement on what to do if the PSI were silent, as it was in this case. Certainly, as Mr. Prey has acknowledged, there was not an agreement by the state not to recommend consecutive sentences. He has acknowledged that if the PSI explicitly said, I recommend these sentences be consecutive, then the there would be no breach by the prosecutor in recommending it. I think the state's position is that, and Justice Bradley, in your first of the two alternative framings, and Justice Prosser, as you questioned Mr. Prey, looking down this list of individual recommendations that have, for one count, I'll just refer to the initial confinement, one count, 18 months, second count, 4 to 6 years, second count, 16 to 18 months, the third count, 16 to 18 months, fourth count, 1 to 2 years, the high end of that is those sentences together.
But I don't know. My math was different. And my math was, okay, what if they were concurrent? Because the PSI is silent. If they were concurrent, the high end would be 6 years, because the highest of any of those was 6 years, and the other ones are all concurrent, right?
Right. And certainly if the PSI writer had recommended concurrent, there would be no question. The state would be limited to recommending concurrent.
That's right.
Concurrent.
But I don't know, in doing the math, on page, I use page 5 of the defendant's brief because it's a nifty chart there, and I look at the PSI sentence recommendations and the high end of each one, but if it were concurrent, that high end would result in a 6-year sentence.
If the PSI recommended concurrent, certainly.
That's right. If the PSI recommended consecutive, the high end of the, I'm talking about initial confinement, is 11 years.
Correct.
Okay, but they didn't recommend one thing or the other.
That's correct.
Yeah, so.
In fact, the at the sentencing hearing, the math, defense counsel did the math and says, you know, this is my recollection, I think Mr. Stephan, is the prosecutor, is recommending 11 years, and I think that's excessive. I think what this guy needs is probation and close supervision. So, yeah, I think both sides understood that what the state was recommending, even though the state didn't use the term 11 years, that was what the math added up to.
In fact, that's what you talk about two issues, but I guess there's really three issues, depending on how you use subdivisions. But the third arguable issue is ineffective assistance of counsel, and why didn't the defendant object to the breach agreement at that very time?
And he simply testified, it slipped my mind. Of course, he's not ineffective for not objecting unless there was a breach, which is why I have not argued ineffective assistance separately. I mean, I think the breach issue subsumes the ineffective assistance because we know from case law that prejudice, if there is a breach and defense counsel fails to object, prejudice is presumed.
Material and substantial.
If there's a material and substantial breach. It's one of the few circumstances where prejudice is presumed. So I think one way I look at it is the defendant has the burden to establish by clear and convincing evidence what the terms of the plea agreement are. At the post-conviction hearing, the defense counsel said, well, my understanding was it was the agreement was high-end, the PSI. Nobody asked him, what if the PSI came back without a recommendation? What was your understanding then? So I think, in that sense, any failure of proof on that point, which perhaps should have been explored at the post-conviction hearing, because the defense has the burden of establishing by clear and convincing evidence the terms of the plea agreement, that there was a breach of that agreement, the whatever failings there are in the record on that point would not need a remand. I would say it was simply a failure to meet the burden of proof, because the defense had the opportunity to question trial counsel, also had the opportunity presumably to question Mr. Tourville, but did not. Let me turn to the other issue, unless the court has further questions on this, on the plea breach. The state's argument, I think, is pretty straightforward. The defendant was charged with theft, taking and carrying away as a party to a crime. According to the complaint, three men stole a safe, a gun safe. They went to Tourville's house, told him they had stolen it, and asked for his help opening it. The men, now accompanied by Tourville, take the safe somewhere else, to a campsite, where they opened it. The other men took the contents and they paid Tourville in cash. The state's position is that the carrying away, the taking and carrying away, was continuing. It did not end just because they stopped at Mr. Tourville's house, any more than if they were lugging this safe down the street and happened upon Mr. Tourville and said, give us a hand, and he gave them a hand. Going back to this court's decision in Marshall, aiding and abetting only requires the defendant undertake some conduct, which is a matter of objective fact, aids another person in the execution of a crime, and that he consciously desires or intends that his assistance, that his conduct will yield that assistance. In this case, the complaint alleges that Tourville willingly aided the thieves in their effort of carrying away the safe. He helped them carrying away. He went with them to his own campsite.
When does the theft end and receiving stolen property begin?
You know, I think this is a case where he could have been charged with either. It doesn't mean...
Not both.
What
I
that?
Mean, he can't be found guilty of both.
I don't believe so.
All right.
Yeah. But the fact that he could have been charged with receiving stolen property doesn't mean that he also, in the alternative, couldn't be charged with assisting in the carrying away. Mr. Prey says it ended when they got to his house, but I don't know why, just because their truck or whatever they had this loaded into made a stop at his house, the carrying away wasn't over. if, as a rough answer, the carrying away ended when it got to its destination. Now, if the men, one of the men had taken it to one of their houses and asked Mr. Turville to come over and he helped them open it at their house, he wouldn't be assisting in taking and carrying it away. But they continued carrying it away after a brief stop at his house. He assisted them with the carrying away, and therefore he is liable as an aider and abettor to taking and carrying away that safe.
Your opposing counsel makes much of the conjunctive and the disjunctive with regard to taking and carrying away. You indicated that the carrying away didn't end when it got to the defendant's house.
Well,
but the statute, of course, is taking and carrying away. Tell me why the taking didn't end by
that
time.
Well, Marshall also says that one can aid and abet without doing any of the elements, as long as one is assisting a principal in doing it. So the principals had to be taking and carrying it away, and he was helping them with carrying away. He doesn't have to be assisting with the taking and carrying away to be assisting them.
Now, if I heard you right, if the thieves had taken the safe to one of their own homes and then called on the defendant here to come and help them open it, that the theft would have ended when they got to the home.
Well, the taking and carrying away, I think there might be some other alternative under the theft statute, for example.
No, but that's not what he was charged with.
That's right. All right. Yeah.
But when the thieves take it, carry it away to the defendant's home, then you're saying it didn't end.
As a factual matter, it didn't.
Well, the taking and carrying away may have ended. What was still the same, whether it was at Tourville's house or at one of the thieves' houses, was that they needed somebody to open the safe. And the safe was already taken and carried away. Now they needed somebody to open it. It doesn't matter to me whether or not it's at the thieves' house or at Tourville's house. Or they could have taken it into the middle of a meadow and called Tourville to open it.
Right, and I think at that point, the argument would be better that he did not aid and abet taking and carrying it away. But it was still in transit when it was.
Okay. So it was not in transit when you get to the thieves' house. It is in transit when you get to Tourville's house. It's not
see,
in transit.
If they get it to the thieves' house, and I mean, we can come up with different scenarios. If they get it to the thieves' house and Tourville says, let me help you take it, I know a better spot, I might be, depending on the facts, I might be ready to argue that that was assisting in the carrying away too. But this case, I think, is easier. It wasn't taking it. No question that Tourville was not involved in the planning of this theft. Well, I shouldn't say that. The complaint doesn't allege that. There's some discussion at sentencing whether he had some prior involvement, but certainly the complaint does not allege that. So I think where under the facts alleged in the complaint, where there was no suggestion that the thieves had brought it to where they wanted it to end up, when he helps them on the next leg of the journey, he is assisting with the taking and carrying away. And if the court has no further questions, I will say thank you.
Okay, let me start where the state started. In terms of the interrelation between these two, I don't think that should affect your decision. I'm not sure the state is asking you to have that play into your decision or not. I think as a practical matter, if you agreed that there was no factual basis, that would then possibly give the prosecutor the opportunity to, at that level of the court system, to say, you've breached the whole thing. The deal was you have to plead the four. Now there's only three. But I don't think that goes into your decision as to either of these two issues. I think we let the chips fall where they may on that and see what happens. But I don't think that affects anything that you have to do.
If we do that, if we just take it on that factual basis, do we have to get to the second issue of the plea agreement?
Well, I call that the first issue.
whatever you want to call it, do you want to?
I think you still do,
why?
Justice, because I don't think we know would the prosecutor move or not move to rescind the entire plea agreement. That's a decision of the district attorney. And I would be arguing to him, why don't we just keep it as it is? But I think he'd have the right to ask that the whole thing be rescinded. But I don't think that plays into it. So I think if you agree with my factual basis argument, I think you still should address the other, and you can't assume that we don't need to reach the plea breach issue because the whole thing will be rescinded. That's a prosecutor's decision.
And footnote 8 in your brief, you ask for resentencing. That's the end of your issue of whether or not there was a breach. And you don't distinguish between the different counts. You just say, generally, if I recall correctly, generally the law is you could ask for either with sentencing or resentencing or withdrawal. We're asking for resentencing. That's, I think, in essence what that footnote 8 says. So I thought you were asking for resentencing. But not so. when it comes to your second argument, and that is no factual basis for one of the four charges, you're asking for plea withdrawal, apparently.
On that, for the reason stated in point heading 2, that's right. That's right. And I don't think the plea agreement really about staying at the high end of the PSI's recommendation, that I can't say right here that was a part of the plea agreement on number 4. I mean, that, in other words, there wasn't a plea questionnaire submitted on that setting forth that is the plea agreement in that particular count.
Well, what's the purpose then of those attached letters? Are they only for the charges other than the one that's the one before us?
I think the letters are just more evidence that there, in fact, was a plea deal, or at least a plea offer by the prosecutor. That's the offer by the prosecutor. That's the same language then gets written down into the plea questionnaire. So I'm just putting it in as evidence that was, in fact, the plea offer. In the absence of anything stated at the plea hearing, that's the evidence that there was a plea agreement and plea offer. The other thing I wanted to address was the state's statement that if it's ambiguous, then it's our burden of proof and we fail to meet that burden of proof. I think the terms of the plea agreement are not ambiguous. I think the terms are set forth. If these, in fact, are the terms of the plea agreement, which I say they are, it's in black and white. Here's the terms. The question is that breached or not? But in terms of what the terms are, I don't think those are ambiguous terms. I think they're clear and they're written down. Finally, on the factual basis issue, I think what the state is, one of the things the state is missing, and Justice Bradley, I think you brought up part of it has to do with taking and carrying away. It's not taking or carrying away, it's taking and carrying away. But even if you just look at the carrying away aspect to it, a case I cited in my brief called Berry versus State at 90 West 2nd, 316, said you have to take it away from the area it was intended to be. Okay, so Mr. That was only done once. That was taken from the home of the victim to get it to Mr. Turbo's place. So, and I don't see the state in their brief or in oral argument kind of saying anything about that. It has to be taken away from the area it was intended to be. So that's what Barry says. So I see my time's up, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for very good arguments. It's an interesting case. We are going to adjourn now, and this is our last argument for actually 2015. So we wish you all a very happy holiday as you proceed. Looks like we'll get a little bit more Wisconsin kind of weather in the next 10 days or so. So the spring we've been having in December may vanish for us. The court will meet in closed conference at 3 o'clock. Thank you very much.